We're coming, and we ain't backing down.
We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Yeah, looking in the mirror. Shut up!
I'm bitterly disappointed with the officiating today.
Guys being dudes.
And they run through our like through a tin horn, man.
Thank you, Lee. Before we get into it, quick mission report from the weekend. Shout out to patrons, Lauren, who came and hung out with me at Tailgate Arrowhead Stadium for the worst NFL game this season. Unironically, I will say, if you get a chance to go see Mahomes in person, go see Mahomes in person. Like, don't, if it's a preseason game, if it's like, go see Pat Mahomes in person, go watch that player play football, whether it's on one leg or two. Go do that, because it is, he is a special, special player. Arrowhead was fun. Fuck me, dude.
What do you think of Arrowhead?
That Christian Kirk drop is going to haunt. No, the Christian Kirk drop is going to haunt me, and Chad Henne driving that team 98 yards down the field is going to haunt me. Arrowhead was fun. Arrowhead was nice. Shout out to the fans who were like around us. I was sitting with friend of the show, Ryan Rosenblatt, around a bunch of Chiefs fans. It was like us and like a whole lot of red around us. So they were really nice. They were really nice. Everybody was really nice. Really chill.
Did the SED fans just come upon you? Like, they just discovered you?
Or they DM me. They DM me.
Oh, yeah, okay, really cool. Nice. Cool. Awesome. All right. Yeah. Shout out.
It's always really nice to walk into a tailgate or what have you, or a game, and get a text like, hey, I'm here tailgating. You should come by for a beer. It's really nice.
That is nice. We've established on the show before, if you are wearing SED home field gear in public and I see it, I will accost you. I am a large, loud person. I will find you.
Sean. Lauren's boyfriend's name is Sean. Could not remember it. Shout out to Sean and Lauren for a good time on Saturday.
Richard, Steven, college football, business of the week. We are going to do a couple things on this show. It is still conference review season. We are going to go through the Southeastern Conference this week. We're going to do that in a little bit. Conference that you might have heard won, you know, yet another national championship. Good for them, I guess. We're happy
that,
for them.
That picture going around on social media that's like, the teams in this circle have won 16 of the last 17 national championships is hilarious, primarily because the 17th is spiritually SEC in Ohio State. But it's actually really funny when you like put it in that perspective.
It may be funny to you. I don't know if it's funny to everybody, but it's certainly hilarious. Certainly accurate. It's certainly accurate.
Beat them, baby. It's pitched combat. Win the game.
So
probably, make your field goal.
Probably going to lead to the recession of this sport ultimately, but whatever. LOL. Hey,
it ain't their fault.
Another day. I think the first thing that we wanted to talk about on the program this week concerns a school a couple hours south of that circle.
Is it in the
geography
circle?
Is right. No, it's not. It's not
all the way in the circle. It's very close.
The circle grabbed Tallahassee, but it does not go into South Florida.
It doesn't go all the way. Okay, first of all,
Daytona is Daytona.
Alex,
yeah.
Daytona is not South Florida. Daytona is an hour-ish south of Jacksonville.
It's where you go when you're at Georgia Southern and you want to go on spring break. Because that's how my parents used to tell me.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me yours. We got a proper mess with this Bethune-Cookman situation. It seems to have subsided now. I'm told Ed Reed has left the Daytona Beach area and he is back home. Him and his camp, his folks are kind of removing themselves from the situation and recharging. Ed Reed reached an agreement in principle the week of New Year's. I was in Phoenix, so it was the week of New Year's with Bethune-Cookman to be their head football coach. I'm not going to go all the way into the last couple years at Bethune-Cookman. They had a longtime AD who stepped away / maybe was forced out. They've had some turnover in the administration. They currently have an interim president. A couple hurricanes have hit the area. Daytona Beach area, and have left them back, I think, facility wise, not just sports, like the university, facility wise. And you know, there's some debt and all that kind of stuff. A lot of financial issues, financial concerns, that many an HBCU face headwinds wise. I'm trying to figure out where to go next. First and foremost, Bethune-Cookman is not a public HBCU. Bethune-Cookman is private. That is different because there is a different, there's one calculus for a public HBCU that has been underfunded by the state for various reasons, et cetera, and another for a private HBCU that lacks funds, because that's a much more of a donor conversation, much more of a student fees conversation, all that kind of stuff. So into this environment steps Ed Reed as head coach. Ed Reed is, you know, the you've all probably seen the video. It's an old video. He's in the locker room at Florida State. They're actually winning the game. Miami's winning the game at this point in time. And Ed Reed gives this like impassioned halftime speech, like a tire of shit. Like, yeah, yeah. Like they're winning that game, if I recall correctly. But anyway,
Joaquin said so dominate. We ain't dominating.
And
I can give you the whole speech.
Hell no. Yeah. Yeah. So look, that Ed Reed, it's the guy's the same, that the train is still on time, yeah. Deeply passionate, deeply emotional. It's just, that is who he is.
There's also the volunteer firefighter speech about the Ravens locker room, which is another, sort of famous. Ed Reed is, I would say, football famous on YouTube, meaning that I have sat in so many team meetings on an embed or just been around like high school coaches that use an Ed Reed quote in their meetings about like, pick up after yourself, be responsible. That's like a sort of secondary shtick he's established.
Also, kids, if you don't know how good this dude was,
he's the best safety in the history of football. Yeah.
Google Bill Belichick and Tom Brady talking about Ed Reed. And you will quickly understand.
Yeah, there's an NFL Network thing. Do you know what I'm talking about, Richard? There's an NFL Network clip that's on YouTube right now where Belichick describes how, and this wasn't a Patriots game, this was a Colts-Ravens game. I want to say it was late in the season. I don't think it was a playoff game, where Ed Reed is able to basically checkmate Peyton Manning. In other words, adjust to the adjustment and then let him think he didn't adjust. And he does it by where his hips are and his ability to close the field by basically going from like midfield back to the receiver in question and picking the ball off. And Belichick says it's the greatest play he's ever seen by a defensive back or safety in the history of football. I think he is the single greatest safety in the history of football. And if Sean Taylor had lived, he might have met that. Maybe. By the way, both of these gentlemen.
Ed Reed, very, very good. I'm always going to be a Troy Polamalu guy, but the fact that we got to watch them in the same division. The fact that we got to watch them in the same division for like a decade plus was a treat.
So Ed takes the, Ed agrees to this job in principle with Bethune-Cookman the week of New Year's, and it then arrives on campus in early January. From the beginning, it kind of got out of whack here. Ed did some Instagram lives. There's a noteworthy one where he criticizes the campus, says there's trash everywhere. We're picking up trash. Says they haven't cleaned out my office, all this kind of stuff. We didn't get off on the right foot here, I don't think. And that happened again. A week or so later, I think there were three or four Instagram lives that Ed did. One was in his car. He's listening to music in his car. There were some tunes that the administration at Bethune-Cookman did not love. Bethune-Cookman is ostensibly a Christian school. Bethune-Cookman is ostensibly a Christian school. And that's what I'll say about that. Remember, Bethune-Cookman is private. So, and named after Mary McLeod Bethune, do some history
Google
to the young folks about who that is. So, it definitely comes to a head over the weekend. On Friday night, according to Bethune-Cookman's folks tell Ed that, you know, kind of a thanks, but no thanks situation. And say, we don't think we're going to move forward with this, all this kind of stuff. If you've seen the Instagram live that Ed did on Saturday, I believe it was Saturday morning, but it was sometime on Saturday. Ed is addressing what looks like the team and some other folks. Bethune-Cookman, as Ed tells it, the school had asked him not to go forward with a recruiting trip, a recruiting weekend that was planned on the campus that weekend. He did, and there were some kids on campus. So Ed is addressing a room of people and telling them that this is going to be it. He's leaving the job, et cetera, et cetera. What specifically Ed is very upset about, and you can tell, is a draft version of a statement that says that Ed is voluntarily stepping away, essentially. That draft statement or part of it is read by one of, I'm assuming, Ed's assistants or one of Ed's staffers. A woman sort of reads this draft version of a statement. Ed Reed is a proud man. He is. And you can tell he is very upset about what he feels like he's being lied on by Bethune-Cookman's administration, what have you, Bethune-Cookman's brass. So he leaves that meeting. The announcement is put out later on Saturday, probably Saturday around noon, that the official version is that the school will not ratify his contract, and sort of everybody is going its separate ways. So there's a couple things here. I think the biggest and most obvious thing here is the celebrity HBCU head coach. That's probably the biggest thing here. It's sort of a Twilight Zone thing. Dion zooms or FaceTimes into this Instagram Live and talks to Ed via the speaker. I'm not kidding, by the way. Dion zooms into this Instagram Live and talks to Ed via speakerphone. Like somebody's holding a phone, videotaping Ed. Dion zooms into that and via speakerphone has like kind of a back and forth with Ed, because it's, you kind of get the sense that Dion and Ed talked before Ed took this job. If I'm not mistaken, Dion and Ed played together at the end of Dion's career in Baltimore. And obviously
Dion was like, I think Dion was free safety or strong. He was opposite him. They moved Dion to safety. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
That was like older. That was like old late stage Dion. Yeah, they won the Super Bowl.
Dion can't run.
So you have a lot here. On Monday, also, the interim president of Bethune-Cookman went on Roland Martin, and then Ed Reed went on Roland Martin. If you don't know who Roland Martin is, Roland Martin is
I was about to check and see how much code switching we'd be doing today.
Yeah, I gotta explain. Roland Martin is an institution of black media. Roland Martin is an institution in the black media circuit.
I was betting you'd do that.
If you are a white person, when you drive your kid to school in the morning, you listen to one type of radio station. If you are somebody like me, who drives to school with your parents in the morning, you're probably listening to Tom Joyner, Ricky Smiley. There is an entire black media apparatus.
Steve Harvey is syndicated across everywhere. That dude has an empire.
There's an entire black media sphere that, if you're white, you probably have no idea exists. Sometimes I bring up, there are conversations that we have around us that we don't have around y'all. That is part of that. So both of those parties go on Roland Martin and kind of say their piece, not together, separately. And you kind of get an idea of Bethune-Cookman's kind of official stance on things. There was also a student protest on campus Monday afternoon that was definitely like the impetus for it was Ed leaving. But like, even some of the kids who are quoted in some of the stories are saying like, this is a snowball effect of, you know, facilities not being bad or dorms being bad, you know, non-responsiveness to requests, all this kind of stuff. It was not solely a bring Ed Reed back. Ed leaving was the impetus for it. So from Bethune-Cookman's standpoint, first of all, a salient point here is some money got to talking around Bethune-Cookman, and you can tell they bring that up. The interim president says somebody from Disney called and asked a couple questions about what they're going to do about Ed. This is before this weekend. That's the stuff that I was talking about with the IG lives and stuff like that. Obviously, you can tell Bethune-Cookman's administration not super thrilled about, you know, the expletives in the videos, all this kind of stuff. But beyond the celebrity HBCU coach angle of it, which is one thing, there's also a different angle of a conversation that we have around us that we don't have around y'all, which is somebody, Dion did this too, by the way. Both of these guys, independently wealthy, independently successful, coming into an HBCU environment and telling the people who have been there for years, blood, sweat, and tears for years into those institutions, that they're wrong or that their mentality is, you know, for lack of a better word, you know, poor, broke time, broke small time, whatever you want to say.
HBCU people do not like hearing that, even if it comes from other members of the Black community.
Right. Like it's you, if you've been there for 10 or 15 years, or not even that long, if you invested some time and effort in that, that message is a little bit better received. But if you get there day one and immediately say this, that, and the third, that does not go over well. And that did not go over well.
Also, the two schools that we're talking about, if we're talking about like the celebrity HBCU head coach, are not schools that were like, woe is me situations, certainly not in football, where this benevolent God came down and lifted them up on his way. Like Jackson State.
I would disagree with Bethune. Can I finish
the thought?
Bethune-Cookman was in a bad way football-wise.
So was Jackson State in the immediately preceding few years. But yeah, that's why you have to let me finish. Both of these programs have a lot of history and a lot of times over the course of that history where they've done really well doing things their way. And yeah, like Jackson State had fallen on difficult times. I think they had three losing coaches in a row before Dion came in and did what he did. And Bethune has not been very good at all for the last better part of a decade. I think their last playoff appearance back before the Celebration Bowl took hold, they had a decent run in like the early 10s. But other than that, I mean, yeah, they hadn't been very nationally competitive and they hadn't been for a while at the top of the MEAC. But like, where there's something here where like Ed Reed comes in and says, you're not doing it right. And maybe in like the last couple of years, especially in football, that might be true. But it goes, when I think about the celebrity angle and especially the way Dion played it at Jackson State, it's like, I'm here to lift you up. I can understand why that would not be cool when these places have already been pretty high.
Well, there's a lot of points in high is a matter of perspective. One, two, a lot of people are still critical if Dion's going to lift Jackson State up at all. 5 years from now, are you going to look back and realize, or like, think, what did Jackson State actually net from Dion's time in Jackson? Okay. All of these schools have money issues. There's too many conversations. A lot of times in football, you can silo the football thing off to talk about the social ramifications. You can't do that here. So if you go and do a quick study, you'll realize that most HBCUs, SWAC, MEAC, et cetera, exist, one, shockingly, in places where there's a high percentage of African-Americans. Two, ask yourself why they're there. Three, spend a day in the library. Four, realize these are also the poorest parts of the United States in most instances. If they're not, Daytona Beach does not lack for money, neither does the state of Florida. These institutions, actually the private ones, have a tougher time. When I was a reporter coming up in Mississippi, there's a college called Tougaloo that really struggles. Speaking of code switching, because Richard and I always think that's kind of funny to talk about as being working together, but sort of living on opposite sides of the racial fence. I code switch all the time in Nashville because I tell people, like in an airport, if someone asks, I'd be like, yeah, I live next to Vanderbilt. I don't actually live next to Vanderbilt. I live next to TSU and Fisk. If I walked out of my house and I had to touch a college campus first, I would end up at TSU, which is sort of a budding Fisk. If you don't know what Fisk is, it's where the diner sit-ins actually started. I don't tell people that because no one knows what TSU is. Do you know who TSU's head coach is? Eddie George.
There's a really good video of Eddie explaining the financial issues at TSU where he talks about lack of resources from the state and all that kind of stuff. If you want to do it, I would imagine that Bethune-Cookman's brass would rather you have done it in this way that Eddie did. Here's the problem.
I'll do white translation because a lot of people are going to be super polite and listen to Richard, but they're not actually going to know. And that's fine. We're trying not to. No one's getting assigned blame here. I'm just trying to translate between communities that don't want to talk publicly because of America. The white translation is this. A lot of these schools are so woefully underfunded and have been since Jump that some of the things that an outsider like Ed Reed, not racially an outsider, but someone who played in the NFL, who is a millionaire, who also played at the U, that's a big part of this as well,
Miami,
is walking into Bethune-Cookman and not knowing what he doesn't know, which is normally just an accusation you could levy on a racial dynamic. That obviously does not apply to Ed Reed, who grew up poor in New Orleans, okay? The issue here is this. I use TSU as an example all the time. I live in one of the most, like, Forbes magazine fastest growing cities in America, most desirable place to move, home values, literally home values survive every single recession, all that kind of stuff, right? TSU is invisible. Invisible. There's also a lot of talk about the fact that historically, if you peel back the layers, TSU has probably missed out on copious rounds of state funding that they probably deserve for one reason or another. Shocking, shocking that that would happen. All of this factors into why someone like Ed Reed walked into Bethune-Cookman and it didn't work. We probably could do this for another hour and a half, and we have to get into a lot of racial dynamics, but then also a lot of interracial dynamics, because the power structures at all those states and places that Richard and I are talking about are still inherently white state governments that are usually conservative and Republican. So there's an atrophy of funding, and there's a question that white people talk about all the time when black people aren't around, which is, do we really need all these HBCUs? That conversation happens amongst whites all the time, especially in places like Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, where the overall state education systems usually are about a crack away from completely imploding. So in Jackson, why do we need Tougaloo? Why do we need JSU Alcorn? Why do we need Mississippi Valley State? Right? I've heard that my entire adult life. We don't ever say that around black people.
Right. You need them because they are absolutely bastions of a type of culture that you will never understand and you will probably never want to understand or hope to understand or try to understand.
Well, I think try is probably the imperative there. Why are there five different black universities in one part of downtown Atlanta? So these questions get asked in white circles all the time.
If you are a white person and want to know the legit, like want to really quickly get a snapshot of the cultural significance of an HBCU, particularly the one across the street from LSU, bet you didn't know there was one of those, unless you're from Louisiana, I will excuse you. Go and listen to Bomani Jones' podcast. This was like a week or so ago. He did a podcast with Marcus Spears. Among the topics, they spend the first 10 or so minutes talking about Marcus's experiences as a growing up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You should go listen to that. Take 10 minutes out of your day after we're done here and to sort of get the cultural significance if you don't and want to really quickly.
Last thing I want to say. There's a funding issue going on here that I mentioned, and someone's going to be yelling into their podcast machine. There's a funding issue in higher education, period, full stop right now. Chances are.
And remember, Bethune's funding issues is a little bit different because obviously it's not a state school. So remember that.
But there's a good chance, as someone who's operating multiple 529s right now with the assumption that my 8-year-old will be going off to college the same way I did in one decade. If you look at the cost of going to a state school without scholarships, it's literally like no one in America can afford it. This is actually having a triple up impact on large. I don't care if we're talking about Dartmouth, Oberlin, or we're talking about Bethune-Cookman. We're talking about some private black school that you've never heard of. We are about to experience a higher education reckoning in general. This is not the territory in which we spend time in on this show, because we're talking about well-funded, well-supported, very popular brands at colleges, right? Like no one has to worry about having enough money to play football at Florida or USC, right? The one public, one private. This affects SWAC, MEAC, HBCU in a much more immediate and powerful way because of the size and because of the relative lack of money. I think Ed Reed, as much as I love this man, walked in and did not do his homework and was so outraged, he ended up pushing himself out of the job.
And I don't, like, again, Ed Reed is a very passionate person.
Yes.
And when you are that passionate and when your emotions express themselves the way his emotions did, I think you go to a place that becomes unpalatable for leadership to see you as the CEO of this program, because the situation very clearly broke contain. As far as the president, the interim president of the school is concerned, there seems to have been an agreement that Ed was not going to do these videos, these Instagram lives, what have you. They're very raw. They're very unfiltered. Obviously, Dion did something similar with the documentary that he was sort of producing around Jackson State and his time at Jackson State. It's why he's doing it at Colorado. It's why you're going to see a lot of uncut stuff behind the scenes at Colorado. That is where we get into specifically the celebrity coach conversation. I'm not even necessarily blaming Bethune-Cookman here when I talk about this, but this is something that I'm going to talk about with Colorado when this comes up, because it is going to come up in the next a year before we get through a full season.
This offseason, for sure.
This guy, Dion, this guy, Ed, they are bigger than your program. Now, you may like get that on its face. You may understand that on its face, but feeling that, really feeling the impact of that and dealing with the impact of that is a little bit of a different story. And that's where we could kind of get sideways here. It happened at times with Dion at Jackson State. Dion had some of these same conversations about Jackson State and lifting Jackson State up and in air quotes and all that kind of stuff. I think you can look at it at a 30,000 foot level and say, yes, Jackson State is probably in a better spot on net than it was the day Dion got there. I think that's fair. But was Dion there to lift up Jackson State for 30 years and be a Jake Gaither? No. I don't know what Ed's career aspirations were. I don't want to put words in his mouth. I don't know if Ed was going to be at Bethune-Cookman for 30 years. Either way, I don't know. But when you bring somebody in who is bigger than your program, you have to deal with that. It's going to come up. And this is what happened.
Eddie Robinson, I want to ask you about him for a second, because I've kind of had this thought brewing since this happened, Richard. Eddie Robinson, if you don't know, that's fine. Lifetime long, sort of the Bear Bryant like level coaching run at Grambling, which is the historic rival of Southern that we just talked about. I, unfortunately, having been around a lot of those SWAC schools in the South here, and I feel like it's unfortunate now that power brokers in the HBCUs, specifically the SWAC and the MEAC, are always looking for that Eddie Robinson. It's funny because this actually runs concurrent in my brain with the service academies, where they're like, We want a lifer. Why would Jeff Munkin leave? Why would Kenny Amatololo leave? You need these coaches to leave. You need to show that these jobs are viable within a system, and that work, that essentially work both independently and then in conjunction with the larger coaching tree. The reason why is you need to attract more talent, full stop. A lot of young Black coaches will tell you privately and very, very quietly, even my decidedly white ass, I'm not going to an HBCU because I don't want to stop my career there. That perception has to change, which, by the way, that's exactly what I hear about service academies. Exact same thing. So you need to get away from the Eddie Robinson model. You need to. I feel like, Richard, we probably should wrap this up because we're bridging into like what HBC, like that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, a lot of concurrent conversations happen when you kind of get into this. Yeah.
It's a pickle.
Look, at the end of the day, I'm not going to say never hire a celebrity coach again. I don't really want to paint with that broad of a brush.
I think the Colts should.
I definitely think the Colts should. I think you should. But you understand what the territory comes with. This is very clearly, I would imagine, a learning experience for a lot of people around Bethune-Cookman and in the way that this went down and the way that this broke bad.
That's the story. Thank you both for talking about it. I feel like I learned something. It's conference review season still here. We are slowly winding our way, though I think we'll speed it up over the next couple of weeks, through the 10 FBS conferences that played games in 2022. We are going to go through roses, buds, thorns, games of the year, SCD dudes of the year. We're going to talk about all kinds of things. But Stephen Godfrey, do you have something to tell us?
Before we get to the traditional ad read, splitzonedo.com. Everybody has what is it? How sad, like a phrase people under, that's probably just a nerd journalism thing. I'm going to stop talking now. Splitzonedo.com. That's our Patreon. That's how we fund this wonderful program so that we can spend 30 minutes talking about Bethune-Cookman ostensibly because we value that. We do not have to adhere to any corporate media waxing or waning of economic bullshit. Am I subtweeting someone right now? I wonder if I am. We are not subject to any editorial oversight. We get to talk about what we want and what you want us to talk about because of our interactive relationship with you, the patrons. Splitzoneduo.com. For $5 a month, for less than a cup of coffee, you get Alex Kirshner at minimum. How many extra episodes do you get of this program a month?
We do at least 6 every month, but we try, frankly, to do more than that. I think there's only been 1 or maybe 2 months where we've only hit 6 since we've been.
I want to say our record was 11 one time. So like you're
under promise, over deliver. Yep.
So you're getting a heap and helping of extra podcasts at far less than a dollar an episode sometimes. So. Split zone
under promise over deliver
duo.com. I haven't forgot about you, Hugh. I'm busy in the lab. Alex, tell me about Homefield.
Homefieldapparel.com, your home for premium, comfortable, vintage, officially licensed collegiate apparel, best in the business, longest standing podcast business partners of our show. Today's a special day because just minutes ago, as we record this, they refreshed their Pit collection. I have a couple of items from that collection in my closet right now because Connor and team there spoil me from time to time. It needs no endorsement, but I'll provide it anyway. It's beautiful gear. There's actually a lot of the schools that they're refreshing right now are getting joggers to go along with the top wear that they have always had on offer at Homefield, whether that be tees, crew necks, hoodies, what have you. It's a gorgeous collection, but they obviously have much more than Pitt. They've got, I don't know, the better part of or more than 100 other programs. They've got Split Zone Duo merch there. Just Google Split Zone Duo Homefield. It's the best in the business. I don't know what to tell you. And if you have not ordered yet from Homefield Apparel, you can use the promo code SZD20 for 20% off your first order.
Alex, I noticed in the Pit refresh that everything now is, I would call it, it's not royal blue. It's like a, like, so I know, I think you guys say blue and gold maybe at Pit, but it's actually like a canary yellow and that sort of like, oof. Is it cyan? I don't know what that blue is. Anyway, my point is this. This is my question to you as a hardcore Pitt fan, because I go through this with some of my teams. Is the darker navy gold era, like the one stat era where they had instead of the script Pitt, but the block,
weird like howling logo thing?
Is that like foreboding amongst Pitt fans, Alex? Like, would you wear that? Would you wear it now ironically? Or is it just like, this sucks, we want our old colors back?
I think people are happy with the way Pitt's scheming it up right now. I think that people got annoyed with the diplomatic, more like navy and gold look, like the Vegas Goldie type thing.
Okay.
The Penguins, the NHL team, had a similar gold for a while. But I think that whether you're a pro or a college team in Pittsburgh, it's really yellow. You know, people will call it gold, but you're really looking for like more of a yellow, like a brighter yellow to go with either your black if you're a pro team or your blue if you're Pitt. So I think people are delighted. I'm certainly delighted. That's not a diplomatic answer. It's just how I feel.
That yellow seems to like be mandatory across all Pittsburgh sports teams.
I think that yellow is pretty much mandatory across Pittsburgh sports teams.
The USFL team. I saw this last night. We all saw this.
The USFL team like changed their colors. Like, to black
and the message was basically like, we did this. Please stop. Please stop telling us to. That's about as much USFL talk as we'll have today. Although it is close to February. We are in the nadir of the offseason.
Boy, I am not watching no USFL. I'm reclaiming my Saturday and Sundays for the next 9 months.
DVR and watch it. Okay, I'm not even going to get into trying to make Richard watch it. By the way, if this dawned on me watching the NFL this weekend because the commercials. Y'all, we have XFL and USFL this year.
Mm-hmm, and I ain't watching not a one of them.
I don't think we're going to make that a big part of our programming here.
That's Alex subtly messaging to me on the air. Do not bring that to a meeting.
Hell no.
I just don't think so. But what we are going to talk about.
That's a lot of football. That's a lot of mediocre football. Sorry.
What we are going to talk about is the Southeastern Conference. It is conference review season.
Ooh.
My loose plan is that we will do 2 a week for the next couple weeks after this as we sort of give the entire FBS landscape the comprehensive overview it deserves. But we've got one this week. It's the SEC. you are probably by now familiar with the format. Rose, bud, thorn. Rose, something that you like. Bud, something that you like to see kind of emerging, you're curious about for the future. Thorn is Texas A&M. And then we'll have some, you know, awards, superlatives that we will give out. My rose to begin us in the SEC conference review is, you know what? So I'm not going to take Georgia. Richard and I did an entire, oh, Georgia had a really good season. They're really good episode just a couple weeks ago.
Did they?
Let's just assume that everything good, everything the best is Georgia. We all understand that. And let's like set the dogs apart here because they're kind of playing a different sport than everybody else. My rose was those couple weeks when Auburn had Carnell Williams as their head coach. And you got to see the beauty of what like an emotionally charged college football program that's playing for each other and playing for their head coach and playing for their fans can do. I think one of my favorite games in college football this year was when Auburn hosted A&M, that, you know, A&M team such as it was, and won that game at Jordan-Hare and had like a jumping stadium, a packed house, just there to support a program legend who was the interim coach and a bunch of players who had been through a really miserable couple of years under a coach, Brian Harsin, who probably never should have been there in the first place. And that was a rose. There was something to that. It was cool to see how Auburn created an atmosphere where a lot of schools couldn't and where it would be really, really hard to actually get people excited. And then Auburn hired Carnell Williams to the permanent head coaching job. And kept things on the tracks, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do together in the next couple of years.
Alternate universes. I'm gonna do mine really quickly. It's because I'm a contrarian dick. It's Vanderbilt. I won't call this a bud ever, but I will call it a rose for what they accomplished, because I don't know if they're ever, if we're ever going to feel in this the future environment of college football that a school like Vanderbilt can be consistently successful. I watched this team lose in every single phase of football at home to a more talented East Tennessee State team in the first week of the 21 season. And then this team this year beat Florida. They beat Kentucky. They are wildly more cohesive and talented than that 21 team. Even after the doomsayers like myself were worrying about like the portal and the nerd schools and how are they going to survive in NIL and your best offensive lineman went to Alabama, et cetera. Vanderbilt had an incredibly successful season given their circumstances. We're just going to recognize that. We're not going to talk about the future.
I'm going with Tennessee, man. It was really, really good this season for Tennessee. And look, we know how it ended. We know what happened when you played a real team, the real team, I should say, in college football this season. I get it. I understand it. It was fun. It was really fun to see the explosion of emotion when they beat Alabama. It was really fun to see the the lead up to that Georgia game. You guys remember that week? Like that we I remember we talked about it on here because Godfrey made the point, the SEC at its best is not necessarily winning in the playoff. The SEC at its best is when it's like October 8th and this is like clearly the biggest fucking game all season. You know, it's the biggest game all season. And the buildup to that, the hype, the emotion, all that stuff that goes into 3:30 CBS that day was in Athens. And these two top five teams are going to slug it out. That was awesome. The lead up to that was awesome. The game. Okay. You know, I'm not gonna.
You can recognize just the hype. That's fine.
The hype. I went to the Kentucky game, which was in Knoxville, which was kind of like, okay, this may be the last time this team is gonna lose. They absolutely handled business that day, and then obviously what happened against South Carolina happened against South Carolina. They were the number one team in the country at one point in time. Like it was great. Josh Heupel just got a contract extension through I believe 28. So he's going to be locked up for a long time there. It does seem like, I think that's his second cup anyway. But yes, it was good. Congratulations, Tennessee, on a great season. It was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun and a great way to end it. We moved to buds. Buds are the things that we liked and are optimistic about seeing where they go in the next year. I was going to do one, but I think I'm going to leave it to Richard and I'm going to pick LSU.
We could both do that one.
We could both do it, but I think that
it's fine.
So I'll do a two-parter then. Okay. I also realized that we just picked a couple of 5 and 7 teams as roses in different ways, which is kind of silly. But the LSU Tigers, you might have noticed, played in the SEC championship game. There they met the inevitable fate that anybody in this conference, except for maybe Alabama, but even maybe Alabama, was going to meet when they played Georgia. And, you know, that was ugly. But I think if you go back to where we were before the season and what the possible range of outcomes were for LSU this year, Brian Kelly wound up getting them pretty close to the high end of what was possible this year. Like, I don't think there were very many people at all who were saying that they could have won the SEC this year, for instance. And I think that there were more people who thought that it was possible that they would even be one of the worst teams in this conference. And so to win 9 games and then tack on a 10th, by the way, by absolutely defenestrating Purdue in a bowl game, beating them, I think, 63-7. And to kind of go into the offseason on that note, it was a really good year. And I think there are reasons to be optimistic. Brian Kelly and Jaden Daniels kind of figured each other out, or I guess I should say Mike Denbrock maybe was more involved in figuring that out with Jaden Daniels over the course of the season. They had a really well-coached win over Alabama, which Godfrey has talked about being like the way that certain people at LSU want to beat Alabama is like, wow, we've got a tactician now, a guy who can really take us toe-to-toe just kind of on a war games level with Nick Saban.
He's an executive and a statesman.
Kind of like that. and they had that against Bama. I think that it is possible that they really rev it up offensively, like really, really, really rev it up offensively in 2023, because Daniels is coming back. John Emery, who has been in college for quite a while at this point, is going to be one of the most experienced running backs in the country next year. He's going to be back. They might have found themselves kind of the latest LSU receiver in that bowl game with Malik Nabers. I don't know. Developing. We'll see. They have had obviously no shortage of incredibly good LSU receivers over the years. And he wound up with that bowl game, wound up, you know, having maybe the quietest 1,000-yard receiving year of anybody in college football this year. He'll be back. Like, remember those two freshman offensive tackles? I think Campbell and Jones, I believe, are their names. Yep, Will Campbell and Emory Jones, who both kind of hung in there pretty tight against some pretty good SEC competition. They'll be sophomores. There's just things to be optimistic about. And so, bud me LSU. I felt pretty good.
Who's next?
Obviously, my bud is South Carolina. Like, obviously.
Oh, Lord.
It was fun, man. It was really fun. Like, I tell people this all the time. People ask me, what is the most underrated kind of SEC environment? It's absolutely South Carolina. Bro, if there's 0-12 and you go to Williams-Brice on a Saturday night, that place is hopping. It doesn't matter.
Not a lot to do in Columbia.
I have seen some miserable South Carolina football teams against the State University of Florida based in Gainesville. Doesn't matter. Place jumps every time. Obviously, the Saturday night in which they basically blew Tennessee's season up for 3.5 quarters, that was one of the funniest games all season. And then obviously it got very sad at the end there, and nobody wants an injury to happen. But the 3.5 quarters when South Carolina could not do anything wrong against a top 5 football team was like, it was like Twilight Zone shit. It was like, where did this come from? And they finished that season. Obviously, they beat Clemson for the first time in God knows how long. Like, it was really, I mean, that was pretty much check the boxes on how a usurper South Carolina team or usurper South Carolina season is supposed to go. Obviously, a little bit of a slower build than you would expect into that peak, given how that season started. That offense was not awesome for a lot of games this season leading up into that. But they crest and they have crescendo the end of the season. And it's really fun. And I don't know, man, Shane Beamer's a really fun football coach, a really fun guy to cover and pay attention to. The way it ended for Carolina was really special. And I think you should hold on to that. And I'm interested in how this is going to go next season with Spencer Rattler coming back.
I'm interested as well. And I want to say that I think some of what they have might be sustainable even after Rattler goes. Like, yes, they're probably going to keep being pretty good at special teams. Like, they were the number one special teams SP Plus team in the country this year. That's a big advantage if you're that good in that phase of the game. And that is sort of what the Beamer family is known for. And also their defense was kind of bad. And like, if you see some offensive regression at some point, you might expect some of that to be offset by them getting, you know, less than terrible or more than terrible on defense, because they were really pretty bad on that side of the ball this year. So, Richard, I share your South Carolina story. I think that it could be good.
I will say the defense is actually the thing I would not use the word worry about, but the defense is the thing that I think you got to pay attention to. People are going to laugh when I say this, but when the Muschamp recruits rinse out, assess that.
We've seen that happen before.
We've seen that happen before.
Ask McElwain.
Trust me. We have seen that happen before.
My bud is the tiniest of buds, technically, by just keeping with the rules of the game. This is more of a bet that I'm placing, and that is in Zach Arnett as a head coach. Bowl games are completely meaningless unless they're actual part of a real postseason that determines a champion. But I think Arnett acquitted himself incredibly well, given the circumstances, as debuting as a head coach in a bowl game. He's hired a very interesting OC that I think it's Kevin Barbary from App, by the way, who helped engineer that tacticians win over A&M. I thought his joke after the game, by the way, was really funny. Someone asked him, like, if Mike was here, what would he have said to you about your head coaching debut? And he's like, he probably would have yelled at me about the time management. I want to bring this up only because I don't think that Zach Arnett is a symptom of Mississippi State not having a fixed AD and Mississippi State experiencing the death of a sitting head coach. It's not like those things happened and they have to be considered. I think Zach Arnett is going to be a very good head coach one day. Now, I cannot endorse, having done this long enough, him being a successful head coach. I think there's promise there, and I think it's very interesting. He's a career coordinator. We've seen these guys get chewed up by the head coach life and the fact that you just can't evolve to a CEO. He's a really good recruiter. I think you'll be surprised at how fast State shifts away from the leech image to his. He's 36 years old. I would have liked to have seen probably a more thorough and conclusive search because of the state of college football coaching, the hiring process as it is. But given all of the extraneous circumstances that I just told you not to think about, I'm really interested to see how Zach Arnett does as a head coach in the next year or two. I would not say, like, I'm not saying bowling next year or anything like that. This is the SEC. I feel good about the move, and I think he was a highly sought after defensive coordinator, and I think he could make the State culture work, and not even in an antagonistic sense like the Dan Mullen way. I just think that they could be a defensive minded team that actually is successful and could just like really make you hate seeing them on the schedule.
We move to Thorns. I'm going to take the obvious one. It's the Aggies. It was a disastrous season, obviously. Everyone knows that. We've been over that. But I want to try to think of it almost as if it were less disastrous and still kind of try to figure out where they go from here. They go 5-7. We had talked about this on the show, on the preview show coming into the year, and this is now the review show, that 10-2 was kind of the number where, like, if you lose more than two games, pretty disappointing. And if you get to 10-2, but like, you know, have the kind of year that Tennessee had, for instance, then hey, like that would be pretty good. Shit happens. Like you've put in a strong showing. Obviously they did not go 10-2. They went 5-7. A couple of those games could have pretty easily flipped. Like their road from 5-7 to 7-5 would have been short. Like there were a bunch of chances for them to have a better record than they wound up having. I think if you were looking at sort of the biggest culprits there, they probably should have beaten App State, just like the way that game went. And they absolutely could have beaten South Carolina and Ole Miss. You know, those were both very possible flips. So like, I don't know, pretend that they went 8-4 or something like that. And pretend that this was like a way better season than it actually looked. And the problem for me is that it still looks kind of grim, even if you pretend that all of their flip, like their toss-up games became wins. Because that, remember that number one recruiting class that Nick Saban got all whiny about talking to the Alabama boosters, trying to fire him up about collective payments. That class has taken like huge hits. Like, do you know who is having the most attrition-y offseason in all of college football right now? It's Texas A&M.
You mean hiring Petrino?
Might not be a bad thing.
Hiring Petrino didn't make him happy.
To be honest with you,
it could be a good thing. It could be a good thing. And to be clear, like the players who are leaving, like it's not like Evan Stewart is leaving, right? Like the biggest hit from there from that class, he's still there, and there is still plenty of talent on that roster. But like, in terms of just the fundamentals of like, oh, you accumulated all this talent, you've now accumulated less because you know it turns out that a lot of the players you didn't keep around. And I think Godfrey makes a point, and it's fair that like they might benefit from subtraction because clearly what they had wasn't working. But I think you're no longer talking about this as a program that for the next couple of years has any real chance to win the Southeastern Conference, certainly at least not for 2023. And so you have to do something creative. And I actually do think it's a pretty good idea that they hired Bobby Petrino, and Godfrey's going to puke as I say that. Oh, but it's like
completely fucking stupid. But yeah, go ahead.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. If A&M does not score a fuck ton of points this year, then it's going to a bad place anyway.
Okay.
They need someone who can help them score points. Like, all right. So like if
can Bobby you name Petrino, me the last time Bobby Petrino had a relevant offense in college football?
I know they didn't score a ton of points at Missouri State this year, but they did put a bunch on Arkansas, and I think the guy can call plays. And I think that the fact that they hired this particular individual
working for a head coach who has never emboldened an OC in his entire career.
But here's the thing. I think he's going to, because if you hire Bobby
and then that
Petrino,
head coach hires an offensive coordinator who is on record as having tried to orchestrate a coup on a head coach before, who's a power hungry megalomaniac. Know,
you hire this. You don't hire Bobby Petrino for anything other than to call ball plays. Like, you don't hire him because he's fun to be around, because you think he's a good leader, because he is going to be good in the building.
You don't put two devils in the same room. It's not gonna work.
I don't know.
Work.
I don't know. Steve. Go ahead, Richard.
I'm supporting Alex's point here. I do think people need to leave room for this being Jimbo's turning point. Like, if you can sit here and look at Nick Saban taking a turning point when in the Lane Kiffin era, when he hired Lane and he changed things on offense, if you can sit here and look at Dabo Swinney maybe doing the same thing, like, I do think you also need to leave room for Jimbo Fisher potentially doing things the same way. Like, hey, this is a legitimate turning point. This guy actually realizes he's got to change here. Now, that does not change a couple facts of the situation, which is obviously they went back to Bobby Petrino. There's a reason they went back to Bobby Petrino and the coaches they missed out on.
Longer discussion for another day.
As far as the locker room attrition, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Like, I think you potentially had some things rotten in Denmark with some of the NIL stuff, yada, 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 blah, blah, blah.
Whose fault is that? The players?
Slice bread's fault.
Maybe the Texas A&M culture that has still yet to produce anything relevant or anything that mirrors their ambition or their own claim.
Also, Richard, before you move on, I would just say this. In terms of hiring good class people, Jimbo's already who he is. Like, DJ Durkin's on this staff, which is embarrassing, which shouldn't be the case, which is embarrassing for both Jimbo and Lane.
That doesn't excuse hiring Bobby Petrino.
It doesn't excuse it. That's not where I'm going with this.
Right.
My point is, this is a combustible situation with assholes. And Bobby Petrino is honestly a lesser evil than other people who are already on the staff. Like, yeah, it's extremely combustible.
I would highly debate that. And I know DJ Durkin's record, but I think people think of Bobby Petrino and they think of Lawyer Malloy and the note and the Falcons and they think of the neck brace and all that stuff. Hey, man, I'm going to go ahead and say this out loud. He was fucking a female subordinate who was engaged to be married as a state employee that he promoted. The amount of toxicity there, the amount of potential predatory behavior. Alex is smiling right now as we record this. No, I am not saying anything other than fact.
No, you're saying
how would that play right now if it happened in 2023?
Well, poorly. It also played poorly then, I would note.
It would play poorly. Poorer now because we've hopefully evolved. Anyway, Thorn.
I realize that saying that, oh, this isn't the worst idea in the world for Jimbo is also grading him on a curve that he drew for himself.
It's a fucking,
by putting bad
it's
people
not a curve,
before.
It's a cliff. But okay, that's his decision. Like, go for it, dog. Like, I'm sure A&M will be really supportive. Oh, wait, they have to be. You fucked him on the contract.
Yeah, I was going to say, you got 70 million reasons why we're playing this string out. And I will say this, which is what I said about on TV show, whatever. There is a kernel of this is the point of these giant contracts. The point of this giant contract is figuring it the fuck out and not firing your way out of a situation because you're whatever. Everybody better kumbaya because you better fix your shit out. Thorn, Auburn, it sucked. It sucked all year up until the Carnell Williams thing. It sucked back in February when they tried to fire him.
It sucks over the now. Summer.
Carnell Williams interim stint aside, it sucked. It was not fun at all.
You could use the present tense.
It was not in my opinion, a good stable situation. I think the powers that be at Auburn have played around with these young men careers because they couldn't get on the same page, wouldn't get on the same page, refused to get on the same page, whatever. And I'm not trying to relitigate this whole thing, but the thorn is Auburn outside of the 6 or so weeks when we kumbaya'd around Carnell Williams. Like it was not fun. At all.
They've got a God-fearing Christian in there now.
Everybody knew going into the season how that thing was going to end.
They got a God-fearing Christian in there right now, so it's going to fix everything. My thorn is, I want to play a blind item game for you. At the midpoint of the season, there was a 7-0 SEC team. I said that they could win or lose every game left on their schedule. This team also beat Kentucky in a way in which they thought, by virtue of what Kentucky had done in seasons prior, I think they only allowed 19 points in the win. And it was like, oh, wow, their defense has actually come along. Of course, I'm talking about Ole Miss here. If you go back and look at the Kentucky game, and this is where I first started to see the canary kind of not coming out of the coal mine, Kentucky had a bad year on offense. Kentucky is making some changes, and that's a Kentucky conversation. Ole Miss used this win. And if you remember how this ends, like Kentucky's missing two extra points. They're missing field goals. I think it's a fumble or a strip sack that ends the game. They have a game-winning touchdown called back on a penalty. Like, they should have won that game. But Ole Miss moved to 7-0. If you know anything about Ole Miss, it's a 7-0 that doesn't include Alabama, who normally would have been on the schedule by that point. Ole Miss finished 8-5. They got out-schemed in the Egg Bowl and outplayed by Texas Tech in the Houston, whatever the hell that thing's called, bowl. If this was any other coach than Lane Kiffin, we would be having a very, very different discussion about the trajectory and the immediate state of this program. But we're not, because it's Lane Kiffin and he gets to do all the fun social media circus stuff. Also, this losing streak was completely overshadowed by the Auburn saga. And if you go back and now watch the Arkansas game in a bubble, knowing how things are going to end, that Kiffin's going to stay at Ole Miss, this is a wildly unprepared, poorly coached team down the stretch. Like
when Rocket Sanders ran for like approximately 800 yards that night.
We're going to talk about Pete Golding on one of the upcoming Patreon shows and more about the future. This is not a good team. And the last thing I'm going to throw out here, boys, is everybody jumped on Mel Tucker about being a portal king. They were disgusted, basically, unless you were a Sparty fan in the Big Ten, about Mel Tucker being a portal king. Lane Kiffin can't
remember. Mel Tucker told you he didn't want to do
that. And guess who hasn't said that? And guess who's still trying to be a portal king every year in the SEC? Just want to throw that out there. You might want to take heed.
Yeah, their best player was recruited by them, Quinshon Judkins.
Does he play offensive line? Does he play defensive line? Does he play linebacker?
I don't know. No, I mean, no,
he doesn't. He plays running back.
But I don't. We'll see. You're right, though. He is trying to be a portal kid.
Call up some Mississippi high school coaches. Call up. Yeah. Like, dog, this is. Yeah. All right. You want to run the roulette wheel every single season? Go for it. Let's see if it works. It's a choice.
All right. Some superlatives as we look back on this year in the conference. The ugly game of the year. I am taking LSU Arkansas. This was a 3-point LSU win, and it was also Harold Perkins doing the thing where, like, you know, one football player can't literally win a game all on his own. It's impossible, but it was like a pretty convincing impression of that, where basically every single time Arkansas snapped the ball, Harold Perkins was in the backfield. I don't know, Richard, within what, like 2.5 seconds maximum for like the entire second half of that game.
Yeah. Like
it was awesome
there. I try not to be hyperbolic about a player's performance. Whew. I mean, it's about as close as you can get to watching a defensive player win a game.
Yeah.
Pretty much by himself,
which does not mean he'll be doing this next season. This is, I think that was isolated.
Right. Especially a defensive player who has a lot of room to grow with a pretty significant part of his job, which is defending the run.
Yeah.
Different story. I'm sure they'll get to that over the next 9 months in the strength program and, you know, teach him how to fit the run and all that sort
of
stuff.
Get his nose dirty.
Sure. But LSU's coaching staff deserves a tremendous amount of credit for 3, 4, 5 weeks into the season saying, this dude is a freak. We have got to figure out how to get him on the field in pass rushing situations where we can maximize what he can do. And that's what they did. And that's what that game was. Remember, what was the final score, Alex? 13-7?
13-10.
13-10.
And the offense was ugly. Like, that's why
it's not like it. Yeah, it was terrible.
It's not like it was the 2019 offense out there. You know what I'm saying? Like, they needed every single sack, every single TFL, every single turnover that the young man produced that day. Tremendous performance.
This was the fire Mike Dimbrock week. For those of you who married into LSU families, you'll remember that as well. This was the fire. Oh my God, what are they doing on offense? Who have we hired? Week. Then that changed a week later, as it does in Louisiana. Richard, we both have 17-14 games. Would you like to go first? And then guess what? They both involve the SEC's favorite team with a story tradition, the Missouri Tigers, who technically are like in the Midwest.
Missouri Vanderbilt had one of the plays of the year in the SEC and was still like one of the worst games that I'm not going to pretend that I watched this game, that I had to at some point in time decipher what happened, because I think we mentioned it or talked about the play on the TV show. Tough day at the office for everybody involved. That is the Missouri football experience sometimes, which leads us to our next ugly game of the year involving
the
Missouri
never
Tigers.
Seen a fan base angrier at an opposing team handing them a win in conference play than Auburn fans after this game. Auburn 17, Missouri 14. This was a parade of ineptitude. It was an extremely ugly game for both offenses. If you recall, this is way back in the beginning. This is like week 4, I think. It was tied at 14 at the half. They decided we don't need to score any more points after that. Missouri shanks a field goal attempt from the 3 to win the game. I think it was as time expired. It was close to it. So we go to overtime because, of course, we needed to do that. Then in overtime, Auburn shanks a field goal. Then Missouri was offside, so they retried it. They made it to go up with it, what will be the game-winning score. But Missouri says, no. We're literally going to win the game and physically throw it away. Nathaniel Pete is running into the end zone to win the game for Missouri and fumbles into the end zone, creating a touchback for Auburn to thus end the game. Congratulations, you gave Brian Harsin a conference win.
Damn, you're mean. You say I'm the meanest one here, but you just slipped that one right in there. Actual games of the year. You know what, Godfrey, why don't you go first here and make the obvious point, but make it in your fun Godfrey way about, you know, probably the two games of the year in this conference.
I don't really have anything mean to say. I think I'm the one who likes to go capital N narrative all the time and try and take things out of immediate or local context and just talk about like, hey, where are we at in 10,000 feet? If you talk about the Southeastern Conference, you have to talk about Alabama, even though they didn't even go to the conference title game. They weren't involved in the national championship or the playoff. And here's why: they're still Alabama. The two losses they sustained. Against
the how many?
These two losses they sustained. Congratulations on making a prediction over 2 years ago.
That's right. Never wrong, just early.
Which is still wrong. Tennessee, Alabama.
No, it's not.
Congratulations. I didn't realize you were a meteorologist. Tennessee, Bama, LSU,
never
Bama.
Wrong, just early.
For similar and different reasons in the narrative sense. Obviously, I don't think I need to break it out to you. I will say this. I'm going to speak a little bit more about the Tennessee one. To the uninitiated, if you were to just sort of, I always like, I have friends from my old jobs back in the day who are British, and I'm always like, if I brought them in, they know what the NFL is, they watch the Super Bowl, but like, if I brought them in to America for college football, the entire thing, like Richard was talking about the hype around Tennessee, Georgia, but if you brought someone in the state of Tennessee where I live for the week leading up to the day of the pageantry, all the, then the actual football, the amount of scoring, the amount of excitement, and then, you know, the fireworks going off in the end, all of it. Tennessee Bama might be the perfect sort of filmic experience. It's almost like a Michael Bay film to introduce someone to this sport. To get that monkey off your back, to end that narrative, to start a new one, to reinvigorate a brand. And I'm going to talk about this with my dude of the year spoiler. All of those things. I've already said, and I'm trying to be fast here, why LSU Bama matters so much. It is because it created a singular, undestroyable proof of concept moment for the LSU fans who wanted Brian Kelly, who wanted to put the knife in Ed Orgeron's back, who support their AD in doing that. This is what they wanted. It does not matter that they lost to A&M and Florida State for one day. They got the data point they needed the most, which was we can hire someone who will be better than the man we have been fixated on since he left us however many years ago. Those things, I think you just can't escape those games.
Richard, game of the year in the SEC for you.
Actual game of the year was Georgia, Tennessee, because look, said it at the time, said it then, we'll say it now. The ability, the Tennessee thing was a lot of fun. Tennessee's offense is a lot of fun. But on that day, Georgia showed why they were whatever you want to say, the standard bearer, one of two or three standard bearers, whatever. There's a thing, like Kirby does not ever shy away from the physicality of the game inherent to why they are successful ever. It's one of the most unique things about him. Alabama, it was the same way at Alabama, the Patriots at the end of their, when they were still doing their thing. You'd hear about it then, like the physicality is the point.
Yeah.
Like Jalen Carter hadn't played a few weeks before that. He played in that game and you saw on the play that should have been a safety. We all thought it should have been a safety. How destructive that guy is. Being in the middle. Again, we can talk about the points scored by Tennessee all season. It was a lot of fun. It was awesome. But at the end of the day, when you got in the crucible in that game, Georgia showed you why they are what they are. And then they throttled down in the second half. It didn't really matter because they were like, hey, it's raining. Let's just run the ball and blitz the shit out of Hendon Hooker.
I'm taking Bama A&M, actually, for my game of the year in this conference. I like a game that is just talent versus talent and very close, but also this was indicative of some things. Like it was like, I like games that suit my priors, my narratives. I think that that's just, you know, more satisfying for me personally as a poster. And the way that game ended, remember with Jimbo calling that very difficult timing route to the pylon for Evan Stewart, which like kind of highlighted the way that Jimbo has this very demanding offense for his quarterbacks. And this, I think in this case, it was Haynes King. And ultimately, you know, just got kind of squeezed out of space to make that throw. Was kind of a telling and interesting way for that game to end. But also it was indicative of Alabama sort of walking on ice and surviving for just a little bit longer before some of those problems that showed up in that A&M game showed up a bit more acutely when they played against Tennessee and against LSU. So I enjoyed that game. And then we will close, fellas, with the split zone duo dude of the year in the SEC. I would like to bring back a note from the August 3rd episode of Split Zone Duo.
Anytime he's got citations, it's bad for us.
I referred to Brock Bowers, the Georgia tight end, as, and I quote now, pretty much the best player in the country, end quote. And I was immediately met with derision. I would just like to resurface that and ask if anyone would like to say anything to me now that the season has ended.
Well, we both have arguments for other dudes.
Okay, go ahead.
Maybe.
Yeah, Jalen Carter's the best defensive player in the country.
I disrespected Stetson Bennett-Kia, I guess is really what you're saying.
I do think Brock Bowers, like, Brock Bowers in his and this is not to take anything away from goddamn Brock Bowers, but the personnel combination of Brock Bowers and Darnell Washington is really what made that team so special, particularly in a matchup nightmare, which is a long way to say that at the 24th pick of the 2023 NFL draft, the Jacksonville Jaguars select Darnell Washington, baby, and pair him with a re-signed Evan Engram.
God, it just never stops.
And Calvin Ridley back right at wide receiver one. the wide receiver core of wide receiver one, Calvin Ridley.
Help me.
Wide receiver two, Christian Kirk. Wide receiver three, maybe Zay Jones, who gives a shit. And then two tight ends.
Oh. No one gives a shit. The Nuke from Napa. I'm trying to come up with Brock Bauer's names now, Alex. The Warrior. That's a good warrior of wine country. Okay. Mine is easy because it doesn't have to be complicated in the SEC, is Hendon Hooker. Redemption arc, right? At the game's most important position. He gets to go from being a quote has been or you're not good enough to play quarterback at Virginia Tech to slaying Bama, getting that beast off the back, reinvigorating an absolutely battered brand and battered fan base in Tennessee. And then, you know, honestly, in a league of pro talent where you have all these exceptional moments, all the people that we've talked about and will, like, he maybe was the most fun to watch. Like, the shit looks superhero sometimes, and that's fun.
My SCD dude of the year, for reasons just explained, is Harold Perkins. It was good. It was really, really good. And I really look forward to watching him develop as a player. I don't know if he becomes a good run defender. Don't know. I think
still make a lot of money rushing the pass, dude.
Sure. I think they're going to spend a lot of the next 9 months trying to figure that out. And if he develops that part of his game, you may be looking at the best player in the country.
Or he's a 3-4 linebacker. You know, I mean, like, it's not the end of the world.
Or you just stand him. Yeah, or you just stand him up and sick him on the pass.
That's what I'm saying.
It's also like if you talk about like Kyle Pitts, for instance, and you're like, I don't know how he's going to be as a blocker. I don't care, man.
Yeah,
I don't care.
Yeah, like,
I can confirm there. I don't care how he blocks.
Darnell, come to me, please.